Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on neurotrophic keratitis, or NK. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Francis Ma and Amy Now discuss how to identify NK in practice, focusing on indications for corneal sensitivity testing based on patient history and examination findings, as well as how to perform testing. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Dompe US. To open, Dr. Now walks through the clinical features of NK, as well as conditions that can damage the corneal nerves and that should raise suspicion for NK.
So what is neurotrophic keratitis? It's degenerative, but basically the nerves don't work anymore, okay? And so because the nerves don't work, you start to lose that trophic support. You start to lose that symbiotic relationship between the corneal nerves and the epithelial cells, and you wind up getting a breakdown of the epithelium, which has an inability to heal itself anymore. And so once you start to have that epithelium that's quite damaged and it can't recover, you just wind up getting a more severe presentation. So it might just be an epi defect at first, maybe it's some persistent SPK, but it can even progress on to stromal melting. And so one of the key features is that if you see a defect like this and it doesn't cause a lot of pain, but it's oval, it's kind of a red flag. Okay, so what clues you into this? What does the patient feel? What do you see? Loss of corneal sensation. Okay. Now, I think that this is kind of interesting because you think of corneal neuropathic pain or corneal hyperalgesia. And in the patients I've seen with NK, they haven't lost all of their corneal sensitivity all at once, except for like maybe with like a chemical burn or something like very, very dramatic happening. And that's why we test, you know, all four quadrants and the center of the cornea, you know, because I think that there's an understanding that you can have some nerve damage, which may produce allodynia or hyperalgesia without being all the way to the nerves in that area are no longer functioning, right? So I think that you can't just assume that because they have no pain at all, that they don't have a little bit of NK. Like, I think it's a spectrum. And so also some things might overlap with features of NK, like the corneal staining in particular. So you could just have regular old dry eye for whatever reason. You could have had an aggressive blepharoplasty and you can't close your eyelids, or maybe your contact doesn't fit well and you've got a stem cell deficiency or glaucoma meds. So I think you have to understand that you can't get faked out that someone might not have NK because they have some pain. There's certain things that are going to raise your index of suspicion as to whether or not a patient has NK. You know, herpes is by and large, like that's number one. Herpetic keratitis is an absolute risk factor for further development of NK. It could be something else that damages the trigeminal nerve. Certainly chemical, physical, like something that's going to burn the cornea. Topical anesthetic use. Drug toxicity, I think of glaucoma medications, you know, and it's not necessarily the active ingredient, but it's the preservative in there. And, you know, if someone's taking 4 drops a day and they're doing that for 15 years, you know, it's going to have its effect over time. Chronic ocular surface injury, a badly fitting, like a really badly fitting rigid gas permeable lens could probably cause some damage over time. And then neoplasms, corneal dystrophies. Diabetes is a big one because they get peripheral neuropathy in their hands and feet. So it kind of stands to reason that their corneal nerves are all connected like everything else. So that's going to be an issue. MS, vitamin A deficiency, like not that big of a situation in the United States. Leprosy, amyloidosis. And then there's some of the genetic factors. These are all pretty unusual. But it bears a good case history. And then there's some central nervous system issues like a brain tumor, aneurysm, strokes. degenerative disease, and then post-neurosurgery. So anything that's going to interrupt that pathway that's leading from the trigeminal nerve into the cornea can cause an NK. All right, and so the neurologic causes, I personally have never seen anybody with a central nervous system cause, but I do, one of my colleagues here in the office did have a patient who had an acoustic neuroma surgery who wound up with NK on that side. But as I said before, so anything that's gonna be kind of interrupting that pathway as it's going into the brain. Okay, and then facial nerve paralysis. Okay, so the diagnostic considerations, you got to look at your clinical history, which includes ocular history, but also dig into medical history, dig into family history of maybe some kind of, you know, genetic predisposition for something, you know, certainly if they've had any brain surgery. Lacrimal function tests, Schirmer tests can be impaired, but you look at the usual suspects, right? It's breakup, which is osmolarity testing, MMP9, if you have it, you got to do a complete slit lamp exam. If a patient has diabetic retinopathy, or they say, you know, I've had a diabetic foot ulcer or something like that, I'm going to be a little bit more suspicious of NK, that maybe it's just going to be like stage one NK. They've got persistent staining, but they've got, you know, peripheral neuropathy. And so that will clue you in a little bit.
With those red flags in mind, Dr. Ma outlines when corneal sensitivity testing is warranted. Dr. Now then brings the recommendations to life with a patient case from her own practice.
So when should you test corneal sensitivity? So, you know, there's some recommendations. Nothing's hard and fast. I think the biggest thing is if you're thinking about it, then you probably want to do it. So, you know, there are some recommendations. This is from Reza Dana's paper. So basically, strongly recommended would be if there's, you know, a persistent epithelial defect that does not improve within 14 days. That's, I think, you know, pretty obvious. I think most people within, you know, anywhere from 7 to 14 days would consider it a persistent epithelial defect. 14 days is definitely within that. So if you don't have any healing within 14 days, you should probably be testing it if you haven't already. Painless newly observed epithelial defect of unknown etiology, that's another time. So, you know, if it's not painful at all to the patients, and, you know, we've all seen patients coming in with corneal abrasions, you know, the lights are turned off, they've got two pairs of dark glasses on, they're tearing. And so, you know, if they're painless, they're just kind of smiling there, and they've got an epithelial defect, you know, that's, you know, probably very suspicious and you want to test. History of herpetic eye disease, I think with an epithelial defect, you'd want to check that. Even if they don't, just to see if they're going to be at risk for a breakdown of their ocular surface. History of procedures that might have damaged the trigeminal nerve or conditions that might have involved the trigeminal nerve. For example, the LASIK, cataract surgery, even glaucoma surgery, any anterior segment surgery. You know, if they had a pars plana vitrectomy and they're diabetic, you know, that might be obviously another procedure that might have damaged some of the trigeminal nerve or condition. And then pain in the affected eye and multiple concurrent risk factors such as persistent poorly controlled diabetes and either reduced blink or a history of corneal procedures. So if the other eye is pain, it has pain, but this eye doesn't, you know, that might be another one, especially if they've got several risk factors. As far as being considered for corneal sensitivity testing, they've got acquired limbal stem cell deficiency, for example, from, you know, something simple as contact lenses or, you know, obviously something a little bit more traumatic like a chemical or thermal injury. Newly observed epithelial staining and persistent poorly controlled diabetes. And then the final one that you may consider it is persistent poorly controlled diabetes and vision changes not ascribed to diabetic retinopathy or cataract, even in the absence of corneal findings. So, Amy, what do you think about these? Anything that you would add to that or kind of expand upon?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of went through that list before of things in your history, but the big, I guess, you know, the clue for me is the epithelial defect. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's just, right. and you know, a lot of times they're not coming in because they have an abrasion or anything. It's just that you see the patient and for 4 years, you know, they just keep having SPK. And then you're like, yeah, you know, maybe I should just test and see, you know, because it should go away. You know, it shouldn't be so yeah. consistent. And staining is kind of a late stage finding, right? So. Right. All right, so this is actually one of my patients who I've been actively treating for a couple of years. She was referred in by her glaucoma doctor, actually. She was mostly having styes, but she, you know, she said, my vision's super blurry and it fluctuates. And she was doing some stuff. She had sleep goggles. She was doing microwavable masks 1 to 3 times a day, which, by the way, I think is like 3 times a day is a lot. I think even once a day is probably too much for a lot of people. If you've got inflammation, you don't want to put heat on it. I think that's deleterious. She sometimes used artificial tears when her vision got blurry. It didn't seem to make a difference. She had pretty bad glaucoma, progressive visual field loss approaching fixation. Her neurology exam has been normal. She's been worked up because of the NTG. She got an MRI and that was negative. She's got a little cataracts. When she presented to me, she had a couple of styes. She definitely had squamous bleph. She's got an APD from the glaucoma. So she'd been on glaucoma medications for about 15 years and her current cocktail was, you know, not a monotherapy. So she's putting in drops 4 times a day, 5 times a day in both eyes. And the cornea has, you know, this is the other thing. I start to get very suspicious when I see that kind of world epitheliopathy, right? It's like, this isn't really just SPK. This is something that's a little different. And her eye, like look at her conge. I mean, so red, you know, just so bright red. The tarsal conge is red. And you look at that eye and you think, oh my gosh, she's got to be miserable. She's got a great tear lake. Her speed is only 4. So, okay, that's a clue that there's something going on. Her vision was, you know, bad, 20/60, 20/40. Her glasses were new. She had lid wiper epitheliopathy. She had severe core Blackie light test, right? So when she went to close her eyes, I mean, there's a huge amount of light leaking down on her cheek. She had punctal stenosis. Her breakup time was 7. And so I did like a Miro challenge. So I said, hey, you know, how uncomfortable are your eyes? And she's like, it's a 2 and a 4. So they don't really feel too bad. I put some Miro in her eyes with no change at all, which would not be what I would expect with someone who had a cornea that looked like that. She's like, yeah, it's like, I don't know, it's a little refreshing, you know. So I knew that was not the right answer. I did a Cochet Bonnet. So the right eye wasn't so bad, so 5.5. And then the left eye had to shorten it, so it was down to 2. So I really had a high index of suspicion for that left eye, having NK. Proparacaine didn't make any difference. And she didn't have good MG function. Her line of marks was all right. Strong positive MMP9, not surprising because of all the medicine, although her osmolarity was okay. Maybe that's because she had a good lacrimal function, not sure. So we kind of went over the summary of what we found. And I prescribed lifitegrast. We did a dry eye mask. I told her to stop using. We did something different. She was using this microwave mask, which I think get too hot. So we put her in an iCloud. Blinking exercises. We did 4 sessions of IPL, a sleep mask for nocturnal log ophthalmos. I wanted her to rinse her eyes out in the morning with some saline. And I followed up in about a month that she hadn't improved that much. No surprise, her cornea looked the same. Okay, so I retested the corneal sensitivity because I always feel like, maybe I should do that on 2 days instead of just pulling the trigger on 1 day. So I prescribed her Cinegermin, and you know she's gotten a ton better. It did not happen overnight, but after about 2 years, she looks a lot better. Okay, so we had 5 total sessions of IPL, and I've probably done 10 manual expressions on her after that. And her meibomian glands look pretty good now. It's like kind of pasty a little bit still, but it's good. She hasn't had any more styes. She's pretty good with her home therapy. After the Cinegermin, I put her on serum tears, And a lot of times I'll put people on 20%, but she has a big drop burden. So I upped the concentration. And sometimes she puts it in four times a day. Sometimes she puts it in two times a day. But she really helps, you know, and her cornea is clear now. I mean, there's no SPK, there's no oral epitheliopathy. It looks really good. Her conj is still bright red. I don't think I'm ever going to get rid of that. But her vision doesn't fluctuate. And she went from 2060 to 2040. And she went from 2040 to 2020. Right. And so, but she stuck with it. You know, I mean, she got a little discouraged at first, but, you know, she kept with it, and she's a lot better than she was before.
That case raised the obvious next question. How is corneal sensitivity tested? Dr. Now walks through the options.
Okay, so this is, we're going to talk about, like, how do you test corneal sensitivity? So it's quite easy to do if you have a little cotton wisp. You can take that cotton, like Q-tip, and just kind of twirl it out a little bit. You can use tissue paper. You can use dental floss. But then if you want to be a little bit more quantitative, you can do a Cochet Bonnet if you can find one. There's the Belmonte non-contact gas esthesiometer, which is just a research tool. And then the Brill. I did a study with the Brill this year. It was pretty cool. So you have some options. But if you don't want to buy anything, like literally, you can use some dental floss, which is pretty cheap. So, or just a tissue. And what you want to do here is you want to obviously not put anesthesia in the eye before you do the test, because they won't feel anything. And no matter what you use, what you want to do is you want to just tap the cornea very, very, very lightly to see if you can elicit a blink reflex. So that should happen the second you touch just a little tiny bit. So if you have to press harder than you think you should, then that's a problem. And they should blink right away. So you're gonna divide the cornea up into four quadrants, and then you do the center. And if you have all those quadrants that are not sensitive, then you know that this has been going on for a long time. And you just graded a sort of present, reduced, normal, or increased. Okay, and then the Cochet Bonnet is, you basically have a filament. It almost looks like a fiber optic cable. And you touch all four quadrants in the center, just like you do with a cotton wisp. But you start off with the filament really long, so that when you touch the eye, there's not very much pressure. And if they don't feel it, you make it shorter and shorter and shorter. This is the Brill. This has been around for a couple years. It's handheld, or you can put it on your slit lamp. It just gives a little tiny puff of air. And it's cool, but what you have to understand with this is that if the puff of air hits the eyelashes or the lid, it's also going to elicit a reflex. They're going to feel it a little bit. So I think it's awesome, but you have to kind of just really line it up the right way and really give patients appropriate instructions. But I think that's a great new tool to have. The thing about the Brill is, unlike all of these other things, it can tell you whether there's hypersensitivity, right? So that's one advantage, I think, of the Brill. It's like, if you have something that should be sub-threshold and the patients are feeling it, then you think maybe they've got some other kind of nerve problem going on.
Once NK is identified, Dr. Ma reviews how to stage it appropriately.
So as far as the classification, there's a couple of classifications. The first one, the classic one, is from Mackey. This is from 1995. So it's not that old. But, you know, basically there's a three-stage classification. Stage one is characterized by hyperplasia and or irregularity of the epithelium. You know, as Amy said, it's kind of that whirling pattern that's going to, you know, really be kind of that picture that you remember, right? That it's not the normal, just, you know, rare punctate spots. Evolving to punctate keratopathy, corneal edema, neovascularization, stromal scarring. So you can see that there's kind of a lot of different things in that stage one, but essentially there's no epithelial defect, but the epithelium is irregular. Stage two is defined by the recurrent or persistent epithelial defects or a persistent epithelial defect without stromal thinning. So it's kind of that abrasion, but this underlying stroma is nice and smooth still. And then stage three involves the stromal involvement that leads to corneal ulceration, melting, and perforation. So this is a defect, and then the stroma is not normal anymore. As far as the staging, again, we kind of described there's a lot of stuff that's going on in each single stage. And so some people use it, some people don't use it. Some people just say mild, moderate, severe. Some people say, you know, anesthesia, hypesthesia, and then just describe the defect. So it's a very broad and very nonspecific. There have been some more effective treatment options requiring a more defined staging system that better reflects kind of the evolution of the disease. So actually, I was part of this neurotrophic keratopathy study group, or the NKSG. And we basically wanted to update the classification system, allow for earlier diagnosis, also be able to describe the various different parts that are happening within, for example, the stage one Mackey classification. So for example, this is the NKSG classification. So stage one is that altered sensation with no keratopathy. So it looks completely normal, no staining whatsoever, no edema in the cornea. But if you tested for sensation, you would find that there's a reduced or altered corneal sensitivity. And then stage two is the punctate epithelioplasty or epithelial irregularity without stromal haze. And then stage three is the persistent epithelial defect without stromal haze. Stage four is PEK or PED with stromal haze. And then stage four is PED with a corneal ulceration. Stage six is corneal perforation. So this, you know, basically there are seven classifications. Stage zero is a normal cornea.
To close, Dr. Now covers treatment for early stage NK, and Dr. Ma takes on the options for advanced disease.
I'll do the early stuff because I would give you the hard stuff. And so when you see it, you know, what do you do? Once you've identified it and you've proven that that's there. So Senna German is, I've been super impressed with that. It's pretty amazing. And like everything from glaucoma to, you know, dry eye to macular degeneration, if you can intervene early, it's always better, I think, if you can get it paid for. I'm a huge, huge advocate for serum tears. They have anti-inflammatory properties and, you know, just general restorative options that I don't think other drops provide. And so, you know, I really want to be putting a lot of chemicals on these patients' eyes. And so I think that this is a really, really good way to hit many, many things that you try to do with multiple medications just in one drop. And it's getting easier to get them. It used to be more of a project. Anything that's going to inhibit enzymatic degradation. So MMP9, I test for that. I mean, I think that I try to get rid of that. Preventative antibiotics, if you need it, I mean, maybe like some erythromycin ointment or something, but I don't just do that unless I really feel like they're getting epi defects, because there's a lot of organisms now that are resistant to antibiotics. So I think it's a little bit irresponsible just to kind of throw an antibiotic on something for no reason. Do a lot of punctal occlusion if they don't have good lacrimal gland function. Therapeutic contact lenses obviously work really well. So we talked about other things you can do is obviously no preservatives, see what kind of systemic meds they're on. And then this is really important. Like, you know, if you're going to get them Senna German and you're going to give them serum tears, but you totally blow off the other contributors to their dry eye disease, it's not going to get better, right? I mean, do thermal pulsation, do whatever you can to get rid of the Demodex, do, you know, just clean everything up as much as you possibly can. But that also includes lifestyle modifications, right? I mean, people are their own worst enemies. So if they're going to be staring at the screen all day, or they won't stop using their fake eyelashes, like, you know, you have to sort of have them take some responsibility for some of what's going on. They have to engage with lid hygiene, and you know they have to put the drops in. So I think it has to be kind of the whole package. Other things I'll do is see if they're vitamin B deficient. Like B12 is really important for corneal nerve integrity. And so, you know, maybe they're vegetarian, or maybe they're on a semaglutide and they're not eating that well anymore, you know? And so I will have people check vitamin B12 in particular, and vitamin D, you know, that's emerging as a contributor to dry eye. So, I try to check all the boxes about how can I just optimize everything.
Yeah. Kind of moving on, you know, as far as advanced stages, so amniotic membrane transplant, you could either do that with sutures if you've got melting, imminent perforation. You can also use kind of the self-retained products as well. Conjunctival flaps, again, that's going to be for, you know, imminent perforation, people with chronic issues where, you know, you're not too worried about the vision anymore. You're just trying to, you know, save the eye. Neurotization is a slightly newer technique that hopefully will help reestablish the nerves and sensation. You know, you mentioned synandromin and how effective it's been. The corneal neurotization is about as effective at closing epithelial defects. You know, as far as the durability of neurotization, it seems to be about the same or slightly better than synandromin. But yeah, obviously, it's a multi-disciplinary approach. It's a pretty big surgery that involves multiple different surgeons typically. Corneal transplant, we wouldn't want to do that really unless, you know, we had a perforation or imminent perforation. And you've got to use some other techniques, right? You can't just do a corneal transplant. You'd probably have to do a torsography, probably amniotic membrane, you know, very involved procedure to try to get that transplant to stay in place, not to melt, and to continue to treat the underlying, you know, problem, which is the neuropathy. Synthetic tissue adhesive, cyanoacrylate, for example, tissue glue, if you've got, again, an imminent perforation or it's perforated and it's smaller than 2 millimeters, larger than 2 millimeters, and the tissue adhesive really doesn't work. Torsography is excellent, and it works very, very well. The problem is patients don't like it. You know, obviously the cosmesis is suboptimal. And then, you know, immunosuppressive therapy can be used as well. As far as some investigational approaches, there are some bioengineered corneal replacements. These are, excuse me, these are kind of, you know, becoming available. Most of them are still not in the clinics. Corneal stem cell therapy is also, you know, kind of being used, but mainly you've got to go to these quaternary, tertiary care centers. Gene therapy is being examined. Thymosine beta 4 is one of these agents that's kind of going through the FDA registration process. Topical insulin is pretty interesting. A lot of people, I think, are using it because it's so cheap. There is no FDA approved product yet. There are a couple of companies looking at making it as an FDA approved product. And then you've got a couple of others, Udana Tag. That one has been seen in phase 2 studies to be relatively successful. And then varenicline, that seems to have some effect, and they're doing a study right now as well. But none of these things yet are FDA approved or widely available.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.